So I've always loved world building and magic systems. And to me, a magic system, it needs to have rules and it needs to have limitations. I tried to create a language, and I'm not a linguist, so it's not going to be an accurate language of any kind. But it's sort of this, it's this language where you smash together a bunch of like morphemes into one word, and that word will contain both who is performing the action and when it is happening and what the general action is. And so you get these spells that say like, okay, and it can change the meaning based on like what suffix you put on it.
Exactly.
Or if you mess it up even slightly, it changes the spell. And I just thought that was really fun and interesting to play with, because to me, it's like if magic is just shooting out of someone, it's like, well, why is it shooting out of them? Like, what's the groundwork? Like, what is the ritual and what is the practice that goes into it?
My name on your head, my image in your mind. You and I are intertwined. Reach out for me, this I plea, as I ask, so mote it be.
There we go, I've just cast a spell on you, dear audience. You have no choice but to be in love with me now. Let's go, let's start the show. At the top of the show, you heard Seattle-based author Sarah Howley, whose book, A Werewolf's Guide to Seducing a Vampire, can be found as a Pacific Northwest recommended read at Powell's Books. Sarah's a USA Today bestselling author of A Servant of Earth and the Glimmer Falls series. She has an MA in archaeology and has excavated an Inca site in Chile, a Bronze Age palace in Turkey, and a medieval abbey in the UK. When not dreaming up whimsical love stories, she can be found reading, dancing, or cuddling her two cats. Me too. I'm Gregory Day. You're listening to The Portland Podcast. More now from Sarah Howley. And I should have read your latest book, Servant of Earth, but I just finished Werewolf's Guide to Seducing a Vampire, and I went into this pretty blind. And what
oh,
a surprise
yes. oh,
this
that must
was.
Have been surprising then.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, not what I expected. I would like to just touch on some talking points of the book. I don't want to give away the plot. I don't want to give away spoilers. So I'll speak in generalities and just touch on talking points. So I didn't expect so much political intrigue in the book. When you're writing this material, you're obviously inspired by current events, right? Or what's political events perhaps in your past?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so this is the third in the Glimmer Falls series, and each of them do have a very political angle. So the first one, A Witch's Guide to Fake Dating a Demon, has an environmental aspect where there's a major subplot about trying to protect a forest from unethical development that would be affecting the species there. And the second one is thinly veiled criticism of the Supreme Court, where it's all about the demon plane and the conservative demons versus the more liberal demons and their policies on immigration and a lot of the more dark oppression that you see from the far right. So that's a major subplot in book two. And then book three, definitely, it has more of an angle on consent. And then there is a political subplot in the background where one of the mayoral election, one of the conservative politicians from the previous two books has to be confronted in book three. So, yes, it's definitely a major part of my work. And I think it's a major part of probably most literature is that it's inherently political in some way or another. And I just choose to make it a bit more on the page in terms of the issues I'm grappling with.
Yeah, so I went into this, I started out on the third book, so now I'm going to have to revisit the first two of the series. Ben, your protagonist in this book, isn't your typical werewolf. He likes to knit, so knitting. Yeah. Are you a knitter? Is this something that, are you part of a knitting circle?
No, I am not. I have no idea how to knit. Oh, really? I feel like Ben is a more aspirational character, you know, knitting and home ownership and things like that. But I just really like the idea of subverting the trope that you see in a lot of romance novels with werewolves. Normally, they're very large, they're very in charge, they're very alpha, and they're sort of running around, you know, smelling people and going, I'm the leader of this pack, and instead to have someone who's just a sort of gentler, kinder person sort of grappling with the aspect of his identity. Because it's very much, it's a metaphor for mental health. Obviously, in the book, he has an anxiety disorder. And to me, it felt like being a werewolf is a great metaphor for that, because it's sort of grappling with this inherent part of you that you don't necessarily always like. Sometimes the transformation can be frightening in different ways. So he's never going to stop being a werewolf. It's about how you build your life to accommodate your specific needs. And how you come to terms with being lovable, even if there's parts of yourself that you don't necessarily love. So that's why he has the not typical werewolf traits, is just because I wanted to do something very different with that character than you would see in a lot of romance. Yeah.
So his traditional traits are sort of buried. They're sort of, he's not conscious of them, but the Eleanor does help bring them out.
She does, yes. So like there is that element of like you don't have to be ashamed of who you are. It is about just figuring out like how you deal with it and how you become the best version of yourself while working with what you've got. So yes, Eleanor does help him with that. She's this very adventurous vampire succubus with a lot of rage issues, terrifyingly blunt, really likes Star Trek. I do like Star Trek, so I don't knit. But
that's
pretty
obvious.
So I really liked them together as a pairing, because to me, the most interesting pairings in a romance, they have to offer something to each other so that they're stronger together than they would be as individual people. Yeah. And so it doesn't mean either of them has to be a perfect person. It just means that their strengths augment each other. And so I thought they were a really interesting pairing for that.
Yeah. And it makes sense that they would get together because they're both predators. I think that actually can lead to love, if you're both of the same ilk. So an interesting observation. There's a, somehow a sandwich was an erotic moment, an early erotic moment for Ben, biting into a sandwich. It was just escalating, this book, the sexual tension. And then it hit chapter 20. I don't even know how to explain it without giving away spoilers, but it's definitely a chapter worth revisiting, and it gets even more explicit than that. Chapter 25 is probably worth a reread, if I'm going to be honest. Masturbation. Masturbation's a big part of Ben's identity, too.
Yeah.
I'll leave that at that. So there's a witch in the book who... it's a complicated character. Is somebody inherently evil, right? That's a topic worth discussing. I also thought it was really interesting you touched on complicated spells too. Would you like to touch on that? How spells can have nuance?
Yeah. So I love. I'm like first and foremost, I think, a fantasy writer. So romance was sort of something I came to secondary later in life. And Servant of Earth is my next book, and that's sort of the branching back out into more fantasy territory. So I've always loved world building and magic systems. And to me, a magic system, it needs to have rules and it needs to have limitations. So you see less of the spells in this one than you do in the first two books, because the heroines are witches there, but I tried to create a language, and I'm not a linguist, so it's not going to be an accurate language of any kind, but it's sort of this it's this language where you smash together a bunch of like morphemes into one word, and that word will contain both who is performing the action and when it is happening and what the general action is. And so you get these spells that say like, okay, like, and it can change the meaning based on like what suffix you put on it. Yeah. Or if you mess it up even slightly, it changes the spell. And I just thought that was really fun and interesting to play with, because to me, it's like, if magic is just shooting out of someone, it's like, well, why is it shooting out of them? Like, what's the groundwork? Like, what is the ritual and what is the practice that goes into it? So you do have this, one of these little funny moments where they're talking about this spell that is binding Eleanor to this witch is, a very complicated one and hard for anyone else to unravel because she's added all of these. It's very personal to her and how she would have said the spell at the time. And it's almost the terms and conditions of her ownership of this succubus. And so it's like all the fine print is going to be in that spell. So I just thought that was a really fun idea to play with. And it was great to write. It did become less great when I would be on a deadline and I would put in like, okay, I'll figure out the spell later. And so I'd have like insert spell here and then my editor would come back to me and be like, no, you actually need to write the spell. And I'd be like, oh, start looking up, you know, roots of words in different languages and then going back to what had I had already established, like for my present tense and then for, you know, if we're doing something and sort of like where the different elements of it go.
The internal motivation of Eleanor as a succubus and a vampire, that's an interesting juxtaposition. How do you write as a succubus?
How do you write a succubus? Well, it's, I think first you have to know why she's a vampire succubus. And it's, so the premise of the book is that Ben gets drunk and bids on a haunted object on eBay possessed by a vampire succubus, and he pays 99 cents. And that is actually the origin of the story because I was looking on eBay to see if I could find haunted objects because I thought it was hilarious. I wanted to know if you could buy a ghost. And I found this store that was amazing and they were selling 99-cent, you know, plastic objects and claiming that these ancient entities were attached to them. And I was like, I absolutely need to bid 99 cents for it. Wow. So I selected a vampire succubus named, it was Eleonora, and we made her a little bit more French for the book. And then I just decided to write a book about her. And so it was almost like the challenge came out of that prompt. I didn't decide she was going to be a vampire succubus. I was like, I'm going to write about specifically the object that I bought on eBay. Mm-hmm. So then I was thinking like, well, a vampire and a succubus, they're both sort of predator creatures. We're talking about that. They feed on the essence of other people.
Right.
And so the question is like, well, how does that play off of each other? Like, does she need blood and sexual energy? Does she need food? Is she immortal? Is she mortal? And how do these things play together as this sort of hybrid? And so that was really fun because then I got to make the rules. So one problem when you have romances with characters, one character's immortal and the other one's mortal, is that you then have to modify someone's lifespan in order for them to fall in love. But in this one, I could say, well, I have decided that succubi are mortal. So she took after her mother. So therefore, I've fixed that plot issue. And they could just be together without me worrying about how to turn someone immortal or mortal. Yeah. So it was really fun, actually, but a lot of thought went into it in terms of how I thought the rules would work, because it's the same as with magic when you have a creature, like there have to be rules.
Yeah.
And then thinking about like how they navigate the world and how they acquire what they need.
Yeah.
She's an interesting character. I love how you write the character as a fish out of water. It's endlessly hilarious every time she does it and just marvels at the modern world. Would you like to touch on that writing process? It must have been fun to write this book. I'm sure you laughed out loud writing that material.
Yeah, it was really fun. I think one of my favorite characters to write is an out-of-touch immortal. And Eleanor was, even though she's not technically immortal, she functionally is. And there's a running joke about that where she's like, but I'm not immortal. And they're like, no, but you're acting like one. Like you're acting like you've been alive for 600 years and you're completely out of touch.
Yeah.
I think it's a really good way to... So I feel like we're so immersed in our world that getting to see it through the eyes of someone who is not makes a lot of it appear inherently more ridiculous. So you can see the comedy in it. I really liked, there's a scene where she's at a traffic stop and just imagining like, what would someone who has never seen a police officer before, how would she act at this traffic stop? Like, how would she feel about
that
the flashing lights? How would she feel about the
fact that was a really funny passage. Yeah, that was really funny.
Thank you. And so I was like, it was so much fun just imagining, like, how would she actually act with something that we feel like we all know the rules because we've been living in this society and she doesn't.
Yeah.
So it was really enjoyable to write.
Yeah.
She was offended by being pulled over.
She was offended. And she was like, well, you're wasting my time. They asked for a license and registration. Yeah. She's like, what do you mean a registration? Where are you registering me? What is this? Starts obviously threatening the officer because that's what she does. She's a product of she's a medieval vampire succubus assassin. She's used to swords. And so it was just, even though it comes at like what is kind of a sad part of the book, because romances always have to have like these emotional depths and heights. So even there, it was really fun putting a kind of very funny scene in the midst of her internal turmoil.
And there's a grand gesture that occurs near the end of the book. The book has a nice bow at the end of it, and even a nice epilogue. I do like the fact that you included an epilogue. Is that something you thought about coming in, or is that something you like to do with your books? This is the first one I've read, so I'm curious about your writing style, your thinking process on an epilogue. I really like epilogues, and I just feel it gives you sort of that closure. Because after you read a book, sometimes you spend a lot of time with a book, you're a bit depressed that it's over.
Yeah, I normally don't do epilogues, but to me, because I knew this was going to be the last Glimmer Falls book, and so each book follows a different couple, but there are overarching plot lines. So like the mayor appears in all three books. And so you see different elements. And then by the time you get this third book, the characters who have already had their happy endings are appearing as secondary characters and helping everyone on the way. So it's much more of a village feeling because you've been with these characters for three books. And so it felt right on this one to say, well, what are they all doing? Like now, if we're putting a bow on Glimmer Falls, it felt necessary to have a chapter at the end. And I think especially because it was so chaotic towards at the end, like the big bad and the big fight and all of this, that you really want to see how they settle into being a couple together. I mean, it's a romance. That's not really a spoiler. It wouldn't be a romance if there wasn't a happily ever after. So the question is, what does it actually look like? And because there is so much trauma, specifically with like Eleanor's storyline and what she's been dealing with, you kind of want to see her settled in a way. But that's the only book I've done an epilogue for.
How do you write a believable sex scene? It gets pretty graphic. I didn't expect this, but I did enjoy it. Writing that material, your process with that, what does that look like? And how long did that take? I'm really curious because that was a turning point for me in this book. I mean, chapter 20 was really strong, and I thought it was titillating on a few different levels. I thought chapter 20, it got more graphic in chapter 25, took it to the next level, but we got a teaser in chapter 20. But writing a graphic sexual encounter, what is that about? What's your process? What's your thinking there?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because to me, it's like writing an action scene in a way. It's like writing a fight scene where you're obviously thinking about choreography. But to me, the most impactful intimate scenes, they come with the buildup and the baggage. So it's not, at least when I write them, it's not just there to be there. Even though there are books that have like their sex scenes every few chapters, and like that is kind of the point. To me, it has to represent a milestone or a transition in an emotional relationship. So you have to sort of have all of that come into it. You have to think about like the communication, what it represents, what has finally pushed them to take this step. And then I would say the most important thing is just reading a lot of romance in terms of being able to write those scenes. You kind of get used to just seeing it on the page. And when you see it done really well, you sort of take that into account. It is interesting. I think as a romance writer, people assume that we are just writing from life and that we're all just out there like, you know, summoning demons and finding werewolves and doing unholy things with them. But it's kind of like a murder mystery writer or a thriller writer, or you get that, you know, dark fantasy with a lot of fights. It's a lot of research goes into it. And it's not necessarily like, and it's a lot of, it's like kind of boring research, really. So you're like, okay, is this possible? Like, is this would this be feasible? Somebody would think, oh, what's the height difference? And you're looking at pictures, you're like, what would that height difference be like? I don't know.
Yeah. Like if somebody is fun-sized. Yeah, yeah. Wow, very interesting. So you've got a new book out, Servant of Earth. I'd like to learn more about this. This has been indulgent of me as a podcaster. I have you here to myself. I get to ask you questions. And I haven't done any research. I don't know anything about this book. I'd like to go in as pretty fresh as I can. Can you tell me about Servant of Earth? And what do we have to look forward to in this new novel?
Yeah, so Servant of Earth is going to be very different tonally, where the Glimmer Falls books are rom-coms in the sense that the comedy is very essential. They're very tongue-in-cheek. They're very they're wholesome despite the explicit content. Like a lot of it is just, you know, relatively well-adjusted characters becoming more well-adjusted together as they fall in love. Whereas Servant of Earth, it's the first in a fantasy trilogy, and it's going to be a lot darker. It's going to be a lot more violent. Wow. It's about this this human woman who goes to the Fae realm, and they live, you know, they live under the fairy mounds, as in the lore. And she gets down there, and it's basically this horrible, oppressive dictatorship where the worst abuses happen, and she's sort of forced to become a servant to these incredible...
The worst abuses?
Yeah, it's not great. There's a lot of bad stuff in there. There's a lot of torture. Yeah, there's torture. There's sexual assault in the secondary characters. Like, I don't really put it on page, but it is very much, it's delving into the darkness of what unlimited, unchecked power can do in the wrong hands. And so you have this heroine who's very unempowered coming in as a servant and having to help her new mistress undertake these series of magical trials to earn immortality. Yeah. So she's there as the sort of the secondary character in someone else's story. It's supposed to be about this fairy princess, you know, going through these trials, earning her magic. And instead, we're sort of, the reader is following this scrappy human as she starts getting embroiled in the politics of this world and then deciding to change it in whatever small way she can. So I think it's exciting. I do think it is definitely a departure, even though this is the genre I was originally writing. I pivoted to write the rom-coms. So it's been really fun just exercising a different voice and a different style of writing, because I really enjoy doing both.
So in Werewolf's Guide, some of the underlying themes are loneliness and abuse. Mm-hmm. And those are pretty heavy topics. Is somebody you know, 100% evil? It's something I really liked how you touched on this in the epilogue. How there's a relationship that forms that I didn't really anticipate. Nobody's perfect, right, Sarah?
Mm-hmm. Nobody is perfect, and I think that's one interesting thing to do with characters in fiction. Like I always like them to be nuanced. I love morally gray characters. I've always enjoyed it just in terms of the media. Yeah, I like reading and like watching. I like characters that are complex and the ones that make you ask hard questions. I think the ones in Glimmer Falls, except for even the antagonists aren't all just completely evil, except for like maybe one in book two. Mm-hmm. And so it's just interesting thinking about like what made someone become this. So Servant of Earth has more of that, like incredibly morally gray characters. And there is like a morally black evil character in it, because, you know, it's interesting stakes to see. But yeah, I just really like the nuance. I like the gray areas. I like it when it's complicated. And I do think that lends itself well to romance, because people are imperfect, and maybe we're imperfect on a slightly less mythological scale than, you know, a 600-year-old vampire succubus assassin who's been enslaved to kill people. Like that's a level of baggage I don't personally have. But I think it's very normal for a lot of us to feel sort of inherently unlovable or feel conflicted or things. And so it's, to me, the romance genre is about the narrative that you are worthy of love as you are, and you can try to be a better version of yourself, but that no one is ever going to be perfect.
It may sound like a weird question, but have you ever met a succubus or somebody who has the energy of a succubus? I have. I'm curious if you have.
I have. I have not. I think that would be really interesting. But no, other than just buying the plastic rock on eBay, no. Where did you meet yours? Can I ask? Like, are they at the grocery store? Like, where are they?
It was a long time ago, and it isn't so much that I would label them a succubus, but it's that energy. You know, the Pacific Northwest, it's there's a lot of different crowds, and for a while I was rolling with a different crowd. So I'm really interested to hear more about Servant of Earth, the series. So this is the long-term narrative of this. You already have this planned out, like you already have your series planned down your head, or you have the ending planned, or how's the structure of this in your mind's eye?
So the second book is written, and the second book I'm actually doing copy edits on it right now. And then the third book, I've begun a little bit of a loose outline, and then I've begun writing some chapters. I'm not a very detailed outliner. I generally know where I'm starting and where I'm ending in a few spots in the middle, and then sort of build it around that. So I do know where the story is ending. So I know roughly where everyone's going to end up. Like I know who I want to kill. You know, I know who I want to fall in love. And then I have ideas for the larger world if I were able to write more books in it. So
foreshadowing,
sort of being aware of the general shape of things,
yeah,
but not in a very detailed, like scene by scene outline way.
So how far are you on the third book?
I've written like three chapters, and then I've got a little bit outlined, but I'm going to be working on that very seriously in the next, starting in the next month or so.
And what's your relationship?
But I have another rom-com too. So I'm just kind of like, it's always something. And so trying to alternate between that.
Yeah. And what's your relationship like with your editor?
Oh, it's great. My editor, Cindy, is fantastic. So she's definitely a sounding board, but she lets me be as weird as I want, which is nice, because like I feel like the Glimmer Falls books are pretty weird for romance novels. I do a lot of strange things in them and make a lot of strange jokes. And she's never once stopped me or said like, that's too far or that's too strange or anything like that. So yeah, so she encourages me to just do whatever I want to put in there. And then she will, she'll provide good notes on the general shape of things. Mm-hmm. Or if I'm having trouble in the middle of a book, I'll be having some trouble and I'll say like, I really need to talk through this with you. And so she'll let me talk through it with her and she'll say, I think you're right. I think maybe that subplot needs to go. I think you need, maybe this character needs to have some kind of realization. So she gives me, it's not detailed feedback where she's saying you must write this. Mm-hmm. It's helping me sort of unsnarl the tangles of it, because I always write way too long. I write very long books and then I have to pare them back and I just try and throw everything into them. And so what I need is someone who can go, okay, I see what you're trying to do, but you need to dial it back. But then lets me decide how I'm going to do that. So I really enjoy collaborating with her.
You must have a lot of trust with her. How did that develop, that trust and that bond with your editor?
Yeah, I mean, it's
really curious about that relationship.
I'm nervous now about than I was at the very beginning. There's almost this element of like someone has plucked you from obscurity and they're going to make all your dreams come true, which is this very shocking moment when someone says they're actually going to publish a book of yours, that they care enough and they care enough to not just give you a book deal, but work on it with you and maybe work with you for years. Yeah. Like that is a very intense and amazing thing. And so I was always very worried about disappointing her or messing up or missing a deadline. But I had to go to her with a book, the second book in the series, and say, like, something is broken. And I was, it's scary to do that because, you know, I always want to produce a perfect
something was broken. Something was broken with the second book.
Yeah, just plot wise, there was too much in it. And based on word count guidelines, I was like, I am not near where I want to be. I think something is taking over the plot. I have too many elements and I just needed to talk through it. And help figure out how to pare it down because like we do have constraints on how long the books are.
Yeah.
So it was just helping me talk through that. And I feel like there's a lot of trust in that moment where someone says like, no, totally. This is normal. It's part of the creative process and we're going to help you untangle everything. And she did. And I'm actually very happy with how the book ended up. And it meant that I had to take a few things out that are going to be in book three instead, and then like merge a few things together. But so it was a really interesting process. She liked my first book, A Witch's Guide to Fake Dating a Demon. She said, we had a phone call. She said, do you have other ideas set in this world? And I said, yes, I have two. One is an amnesia, enemies to lovers, road trip romance. And then one is a werewolf who buys a vampire succubus on eBay. Yeah. And she was like, great. And then she worked that into the deal so that I would write all three of those and she would work with me on them. Mm-hmm. And then she's just basically like the Servant of Earth was also a conversation about what else I had, because Servant of Earth was actually already written. It was one of the first books I wrote, and now is kind of the time to be jumping on the fantasy romance trend. It's very popular right now with Fourth Wing. And so we're sort of talking through, like, I'm like, I have this old project. If you're interested, she's like, I am interested. So she took another look at it. And then decided to do that. So yeah, so your editor is baked into the process. They're not just assigned to you. Like, they are the ones that choose the projects they want to work on for the imprint. Yeah. And I just feel very lucky.
That's very exciting. And you're doing a great job promoting this book.
Oh, thank you. You're really
putting yourself out there.
I mean,
that's a skill in itself.
Social media is the worst part.
Is it? Do you enjoy it? I mean, do you enjoy going to book tours and that kind of thing?
Oh, I love going to book events. I like talking to readers. I like podcasts. I like all of that. Social media, I just feel like I'm not good at it. So there's this element of like, oh no, like trying to make graphics, trying to figure out how to be online without being too online, because it's stressful. I think everyone knows, like, social media makes us all very, very stressed out. So you're just trying to figure out how to promote yourself effectively while also like staying true to what your voice is and what you have the space for.
And you really like the cover art too. You got very excited on social media about the cover art for this book. You felt it captured the theme, the mood, the vibe, so to speak.
No, I'm of all the covers I've had, I'm just amazing. And they're very different. So like Jess Miller is the illustrator for Glimmer Falls and does this wonderful, I love the colors that she does. I like how whimsical it feels. I like all the little elements in the corner. You look at it and you're like, that looks cute and cozy, which it is. Yeah. And then Orion Macua was the Servant of Earth cover artist. Sorry, my cat is trying to knock over my computer right now. And just this very, you know, stylized, almost old school fantasy look that I was just obsessed with from the start. So I love how different the series are and that they reflect the tone of the story within.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really enjoyed this book. I wish I would have read the new one. I thought it was new. I just finished Wolfish right before this. That's why I jumped. This Werewolf's Guidebook is a recommended book at Powell's. Were you aware of that?
I did not. I've seen pictures of it there, but I did not know it was one of the recommended books. That's wonderful. Yeah. I love Powell's. Absolutely.
It is. They have a Pacific Northwest section, and that also made it interesting for me to reach out to you to have a chat about this book. Do you visit Portland often? This is a podcast about Portland, but you're Pacific Northwest. We're voracious readers here.
I've been to Portland a few times and I love it. Absolutely love Portland. I would love to come down and visit. I have some friends in the city.
You do?
It's been like 5 or 6 years since I've been, but I would really like to go back.
Any writer friends that you could recommend I reach out to?
let me think. I'm trying to think who's actually there, because a lot of my friends there are so I used to write fan fiction. And so I know people from the fan fiction community that are in Portland.
It's a very tight-knit community. Feel free to tell your publicist. It's a very supportive scene of writers, poets. Literary Arts is a very big institution here. And you're a big name in the industry. And
amazing.
Wish you the best success moving forward. So you said you perhaps have another book on the horizon.
Yes, I have. I have quite a few books on the horizon. Yes. Really? So there's going to be the second and third in the fantasy trilogy, and then there are going to be some more paranormal rom-coms coming. So I don't have titles for those yet, but they're on the way. So I guess hopefully the idea, I would love to just be able to keep doing this and writing in both genres.
Yeah.
I'd love to branch out to sci-fi at some time. I have like this sci-fi gothic idea I'd love to do.
Sci-fi gothic?
I just feel like there's so many.
Sci-fi gothic? Yeah. Tell me more about that.
I mean, it's a sort of this scientific mission to go, you know, so you've got the, it would be following an anthropologist. Yeah. So it'd be like the anthropologist and the biologist and these various people going to sort of test out, learn more about a new planet and the citizens there to sort of, as they think about adding it to their, you know, Federation style galactic empire. But a strange hauntings occur on the ship along the way. So that's an idea that's been in the back of my mind for a really long time. And it's mostly written, but it was, gosh, I don't even know how long ago it was, probably like 8 years or more that I was writing it. So I would have to revisit it.
So how'd you get so good at writing rom-coms? Is this just something you're just naturally good at, or you know?
Oh, that's really nice of you. I think the comedy element was kind of surprising because I hadn't been trying to do that before. But then, like I said, I was writing fan fiction, and I started practicing a funny voice in fan fiction. And it wasn't something I'd attempted before. And I was just writing my sense of humor and practicing it and realized it was really enjoyable. So I would say that would be my training, was just sort of writing these sort of goofy, wry, tongue-in-cheek, slightly absurdist Star Wars contemporary AUs was where I got the rom-com voice.
I instantly took to Eleanor in the book, and I just laughed when someone said she was almost feral. I just thought that was a hilarious thing to say about another person.
Yeah,
the comedy is inherent.
I love a feral heroine. I love it. There's one in Servant of Earth, too. They also call her feral.
Really?
Just the idea of these these heroines sort of baring their teeth at the world, I think, is a really fun character to write.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Sarah. I'll publish this very shortly. Thanks so much to your publicist for making this happen. Glad that you're working on different projects. Sounds like some fun projects on the horizon. Hope to visit you at Powell's when you have a book reading tour. Thanks again.
That would be wonderful. Well, thank you very much. This has been great.
Much obliged, and hopefully talk soon. Cheers. Thank you, Sarah.
All right, sounds
au revoir.
Good. Bye.
Today's show was produced and edited by Gregory Day. That's me. If you'd like to reach out to me directly, you can reach me at blahblahblah.com. I'll reach out to you. You don't need to reach out to me. Don't worry about that. I get a lot of spam, but feel free to email me anytime at greg@pdxpodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening to the show, supporting the show. It's a non-profit venture. I don't make any money off this. I'm not even sure why I do it, to tell you the truth. But thank you for listening and making it this far. I do appreciate you listening. It really does mean something to me. So, talk soon.